Kennedy, the San Francisco Dreet.
And Dave.
Capro.
Welcome to Discography.
Yes, we are the hosts of Discography, which is the music podcast that delivers the objective truth about the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever existed. Speaking of San Francisco, so Joe and I actually lived in San Francisco together for a very turbulent period of time.
Which is like a little like a Lennon Lost Weekends thing, but for a couple of years.
This is very...
With weed instead of booze and coke.
Right. It wasn't that dilapidated, but I actually went out to San Francisco, as did Joe, in sort of this all-inclusive project. Joe had a band that was initially called Cornerstone Red, then it was called Archaeology, and I had a script for a film called Jesus 2.
Yeah, we were supposed to score the movie.
Right, and they were proggy and naughty, wouldn't you say?
I feel like we were going for proggy, we were going for like ECM jazz kind of, but when I listen to that stuff now, it mostly sounds like kind of like hippie jam music.
Right, and when I look
we're trying to do like Pink Floyd metal meets Bitches Brew.
You guys had moments, you really did.
Had moments.
And when I look at Jesus 2, the script for Jesus 2, I'm beyond embarrassed, but at the time I was on a mission. I had 60 grand I'd raised in cash and 40,000 in credit cards. This was the Clerks era, and I think the best that could be, the movie was never completed, unfortunately. Production broke down, but if a Dave and Joe of the future did a Discography trawl of Dave and Joe, us...
This is getting way too meta.
No, you guys are, this is Back to the Future.
Even I don't even get it. And I live in this timeline.
Right, so if you did a trawl of that period of our lives, you would deem it nascent.
I give it one star.
I give the agony 5 stars, though.
I give being a young person 5 stars. And I During give that, actually living through that 1 star.
Before we progress into the musical portion, I just want to say during that time, I actually lived in a closet.
It was a pretty big closet. Actually, you know what? It wasn't really that big.
Of a closet.
It was kind of just a normie closet.
Because there were 16 people in my 2-bedroom apartment when we shut down filming. And to get some privacy, I moved into my frickin' closet. I lived in my closet.
Oh, the 90s. Mm. Today, we are resuming our career-long dissection of Sly and the Family Stone.
Welcome to part 2 of Sly and the Family Stone. And just to recap, on this show, what we do is we take an artist or band's entire discography, and we everything from albums to EPs to singles, we give everything a star rating from 0 to 5, including half stars, because we are very, very...
Precise
in our opinions.
Scientific.
And we can explain why we give it the star rating that we do. In any case, everything gets a star rating. Everything gets reviewed.
You get a star rating.
Yeah, you get a star rating. All right, so just to go right into it, at this point, it is in 1970, and Sly begins showing up late to shows, or not even bothering to show up at all, and it actually caused riots, including a really bad one in Chicago. So the performances, when they did happen, apparently were often erratic, half-hearted, and pissed off. It was something that snuck up on him, Joe. It was like initially a Vegas-type building of tension thing.
Yeah, and then this becomes like the dominant thing in his life, like the not showing up for shows thing. You wonder if he didn't have that problem, his career arc probably would have gone a lot differently, because it took
he
away...
He alienated so many people.
Yeah. Well, I guess the not showing up for shows is really just a symptom of some other problems.
So check this bullshit out. And I say this with great respect, because I really am an enormous fan of Sly and the Family Stone, but this is totally irresponsible. So in 1970, Sly canceled 26 out of 80 shows. That's fucking ridiculous.
It's like Morrissey level.
I don't understand that at all, how you can have a career doing stuff like that. So in February 71, Sly actually missed 5 concerts in a row. I mean, one time Sly showed up 5 hours late for a concert at Constitution Hall in D.C., and the crowd started throwing rocks and bottles. And the police arrested 18 people, and windows were broken for blocks in every direction.
And they never had a concert.
They never had a concert there again. Yeah. This was just typical for Sly's show. So I think psychologically, after a Vegas-type tension builder, it became like a power trip. Like, everything is going to be on my time, damn it, not yours. But soon he began not showing up at all, I think, because PCP, PCP, the nickname for this is Sherm. The effects of PCP, I've never done it, never been interested in doing it, are very, very gruesome to watch, really, really disturbing to watch. But anyway, he began missing shows. He began philosophizing about the irrelevant nature of time itself. He would always say, "I make time." So all of a sudden, getting him to every single concert became a major ordeal, like a brutal, twisted game that he insisted on playing over and over again for the rest of his
life. How much do you think of this as, so yeah, he's definitely, they're doing PCP, but there's also, like, it seems like everybody's doing a lot of coke.
Yeah, well, a PCP and coke, I don't understand why you wouldn't just drink a cup of coffee and smoke a joint. Why do you have to almost literally rip your physiology in two separate pieces? I mean, that's, I don't get it. Doesn't it just, PCP
well,
and
cocaine,
coke, wouldn't
cocaine
that just make
is like
you normal?
Cocaine is like a dopamine hit, right? So you're kind of getting this sort of like a rush of pleasure.
Why would you want to be so up and so down at the same time? Where is the impulse to do that coming from? So,
It's kind of common though. I mean, that's why people do speedballs. That's, you know, like that's what Elvis was doing. You know, it's right. Like a, you know, because, well, it, I mean, I don't know. I've never been that, never really, you know,
I don't have a purple
dabbled
heart.
In anything.
I don't have a purple heart and courage for doing stuff like that.
But I could see the logic behind it. You get really super high and you're way up and you're like,
why would you do that?
Oh,
it
shit.
Gets you real high.
Oh, shit. I got to get down. How do I get down?
Right.
You get something that brings you back down. And oh, forth. No, I'm down. Now what?
Now what? Yeah.
It seems like it's not that hard to figure out how that can happen.
So, listen. Everybody, you have to just, you know, just trust us that we're going on the right path here. This is not discographical, but on July 13th, 1970, there was an event that has to be talked about. Sly and the Family Stone were due to appear on the Dick Cavett Show. And the word was out from on high. If Sly didn't get to the Dick Cavett Show, he was a done deal.
I guess this is record company people telling him this?
I'm not sure how it got to him, but he had to be there. So they pulled out all the stops to get Sly there. So this whole crazy fucking story, one of the craziest stories I've ever heard in rock history, started with a gig in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. So afterwards, Sly and the Family Stone were invited to Muhammad Ali's house. That's a no fucking brainer. Sly had to go. You don't turn down an invite like that. So the next morning, Bubba Banks, he woke up in his New York hotel room to find that Sly had completely flown the coop. So it turns out that Sly had taken a plane to L.A. To score dope, as if dope didn't exist in New York.
Well, he knew a guy in L.A.
He knew a certain guy in L.A. Unfortunately, though, he was due to appear on the Dick Cavett Show in only a few hours in New York. So Bubba reached out to his buddy, Bobby Womack, for assistance.
He was kind of hanging around a lot around the sessions for the records and stuff. He's kind of getting to be an inner circle kind of guy.
He's an integral part to the Riot story. He's more integral than the band, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. He's
Is it integral or integral or both?
Integral.
Is it both or in one?
It's more integral.
I was just wrong.
I don't think it's integral.
Okay. All right. Please write in on the...
I would think it's actually integral. He's an integral part of the band.
That's what I once thought. It was a Rico Errico thing for me. All right. So...
this podcast is really showing how much we read and how little we interact with human beings.
How unerudite I've become at 49 years old. So Bobby Womack was asked to go over to the Bel Air House to get Sly to the airport and bring him back to New York. Very, very simple, upfront and very straightforward. Womack says Sly just found every excuse to not go to that show. You take him downstairs and he says, "I got to go back upstairs." This goes on for 2 hours. So they go to an aviation space in New York, and Bubba, realizing it was going to be a close call, had a helicopter that was waiting to rush Sly downtown. to the studio for the live broadcast.
Say what you want about Bubba. He's getting shit done.
He is getting shit done, although it's not actually getting done, unfortunately. So Sly disappeared in the bathroom of Butler Aviation in New York, and Bubba couldn't find him. So Bubba looks up under the toilet door, and Sly's got both feet up, so he can't be seen, and he's kneeling down snorting cocaine, which, by the way, this is how Bubba describes it, but how do you have your feet up and be snorting cocaine? Wouldn't that be just impossible?
He must have had to crouch on the toilet like a baseball catcher, and then have like
I picture him like diagonally upside down. Anyway, so the helicopter only had room for two, so Sly and Bobby Womack boarded, and Bubba headed downtown by car. Bubba looks back over his shoulder as he drives off and sees that, unbelievably, the fucking helicopter was turning back. So Bubba turned back to see what the fuck was going down. It turned out that the wind in the front seat was blowing Sly's drugs around. So he insisted the pilot return to the terminal so he and Bobby could switch seats. Which is one of my favorite little facts.
I love that. I love the guy who must be the helicopter pilot.
The pilot, yeah. Best gig ever. So by the time Bubba reached ABC, Sly had locked himself in the dressing room of the Dick Cavett Show. The band was waiting. The show was airing. It was live. Bubba literally broke the door down and escorted Sly down the circular staircase to the set, where he stood alongside the band members. Cavett looked into the camera and solemnly announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, Sly and the Family Stone." Sly then whispered into Bubba's ear, "Bub, I got diarrhea. I gotta go." And he hightailed it back up the circular staircase. So let's talk about that. I know I just talked a lot, but I am just so taken with that story. I also want to thank for details Joel Selvin for one of the possibly my favorite Mojo article of all time from the August 2001 issue.
Yeah, if you can track that down, the article about Sly.
It's a masterpiece. He also created an amazing book in oral history of Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, that's the Mojo article is just bonkers. There's a lot more than that.
It's so entertaining. So, Joe, let's talk about the Cavett interview, and also
First, Dick Cavett himself is this kind of like square but intellectual foil to many hippies of this time, right? So he's kind of a character. Yeah. He's sort of this
he's
sort
like,
of tight-lipped.
He's the square for the hip crowd.
Yes.
He's like the guy who could gain entry into that world.
Right. He's a square, but he's friendly with the hippies.
He's hip enough, like the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
So Sly comes on. He's noticeably licking his lips, grinding his teeth.
He's noticeably on the planet like Uranus, Neptune.
But the weird fucking thing about this appearance, and I've seen it so many times, and you can find it on YouTube.
Definitely worth
just
watching.
Look up Dick Cavett. Sly Stone, July 13, 1970. And the interesting thing is he is completely lucid, but he's bonkers at the same time. He's not nervous, but he's just absent.
Yeah, he's just coming from another planet, you know?
He's totally from another place. So, you know, this... and then oddly, when they play, I mean, they are so... It's so incendiary. The performance is so ridiculously good.
Well, some musicians, they do drugs and the music suffers for it. Not Sly. Sly can get really high.
He can get deep.
He
in
can
the
go
funk,
and
like quicksand.
In
funk.
Fact, it's some people have, not to glorify drug use because the amounts that Sly did really ruined him as a person, but. He's transmitting from like another plane. It's another sphere of existence that he's coming from. Like some of the more druggy performances that you get out of him in the next, especially on the next album.
The music in some ways, especially the music he was going to make, it almost was mocking, especially the horn lines, like things like Running Away and You Caught Me Smiling, which obviously comes up later on, but... You know, this is music that mocks him. The lyrics slices himself up in a therapeutic, in an uncomfortable therapeutic way. And, at this point, he's all the boxes of tapes, the hours and hours of smacked out playing and recording, results in an actual record. On November 1st, 1971, that record is released. Initially, it was to be called Africa Talks to You. Then Marvin Gaye's What's Going On comes out 6 months before Riot comes out, and instead it was retitled in response to Marvin's query. It was now called There's a Riot Going On.
And it's one of the greatest records ever made. Certainly,
it's in my top 10.
Certainly one of my favorite albums of all time. It is maybe the most extreme example of a time and place record, where just the sweaty, drugged out, desperate vibe of that his home studio is just palpable.
You know, the whole end of the 60s, ascribing the end of the 60s to something, you know, was it Altamont? I mean, Riot actually serves as a potential monument to something that could be a signifier of the end of the 60s.
Well, I mean, you know, look, the end of the 60s, I think, meant a lot, something a lot different to the black community. You know, like they, you know, you look at the civil rights movement and the massive climb that just to get basic, the most basic forms of equality, just to be able to drink out of water fountains. Like
right.
How much bloodshed had to go into that.
So concepts like that to a lot of people who Sly actually grew up with on the streets, I mean, these were literally just that. They were concepts. They weren't things that were acted out on H Street.
Yeah, so the end of the 60s thing means something a lot different.
Potentially nothing to him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's I think the there's a disillusionment very justifiably creeping in that, you know, things may be getting a little better, but there's still a really, really long way to go.
I just want to say that, you know, the word negation.
Yeah.
Negation is an overriding factor here on these recordings. And this is their fifth album, There's a Riot Going On. And out of nowhere, there's complete and total darkness after years of pure light. So most of these tunes were recorded using overdubbing as opposed to the way they'd done everything up to this point.
Yeah, and I think by the time this came out, the actual Family Stone band,
they were done.
Yeah, they were kind of, you know, they make some cameos on this. But it was that thing of like, whoever happens to be around, come on down and play on this, you know.
Mainly the horn section, though, because Stone wound up playing most of the parts himself and performed more of the lead vocals than was usual. There was not that group harmony thing.
The style of funk on this itself starts to change. It's some of the songs in this especially have a sort of dense and like knotty kind of funk to them. Kind of scary. But then
I would say it's scary. Like as a kid hearing this stuff, you know, I was maybe 13, 14 when I heard it. It seemed dark and impenetrable.
Well, the world of like that was
Bitches Brew.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that the world that I think, you know, this record really influenced Miles, and that sort of that same kind of knotty.
Thanks to Betty Davis, who we'll be covering soon.
That same knotty kind of dense, almost like prog at some points. How complicated some of the riffs get.
The Asphalt Jungle, definitely prog.
But still extremely funky.
Not dance funky, lay down funky.
Yeah, it's kind of the funk that Miles, the same like avenue of funk that Miles would explore in like On the Corner.
You know, Sly, one interesting aspect of the recording, you know, since we're talking about those knotty tangles, on top of the knotty tangles and that prog-like funk, you have this thick, dense blanket of tape hiss due to the recording and re-recording and re-recording.
I think part of it is probably due to the constant, they would go over the tapes a million times, but then it's probably, I don't think there's like A-plus levels of engineering happening at this time. I don't think they're really like, I think some of these things are probably recorded badly with all like noise. And
he was never happy with what he had. What I've recounted is the Family Stone as a band are only playing together on the last track. Besides that, you have tons of Sly. You have Bobby Womack, mm-hmm. Jim Ford, who wrote the song Harlan County. Mm-hmm. Joe Hicks is around. Ike Turner's around. Billy Preston is around. Not only is he around, he plays the fucking organ on Family Affair.
Yeah.
Herbie Hancock's around. He even titled the song Sly on Headhunters. And Miles Davis is on blow and keyboards, not trumpet. With
you can hear him. You can hear him if you turn up way in the background. You can hear like
you can hear sniff percussion. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, not to getting back to the sound of the record, you know, yes, there is tape hiss. Yes, there's less than optimal sound engineering on a lot of this, but it sounds great.
It's one of the best sounding albums ever.
Not to suggest at all that I don't like the way this record sounds. Quite the contrary.
I wish all of his records sounded like this.
Yeah, it sounds like when you put it on the turntable, it sounds like the record, there's something wrong with it.
Yeah,
like good way.
It actually sounds like the master tapes were coated in human feces. Seriously. It sounds like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre looks.
Also, the style of vocal recording, it's very dry, very unprocessed.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
One of the
Not only that, but he's not standing when he's doing a lot of the vocals. He's laying down because he's too fucked up.
Sometimes the vocals go crazy into the red. Where yeah. They're just burying the needle, and that's like what the compression is,
and it's
quote unquote.
Part of the music.
Instead of putting on a compressor on something, they'll just bury something in the red, and that's there's an energy to that.
Yeah,
there's an urgency to it.
Sly wanted to release the first track as the first track on the album is the first single.
Yeah, Love and Hate, which
Love
is
and Hate.
Very uncommercial. Thing to be a single.
It's kind of like a PCP advertisement.
Yeah,
feels so good, don't want to move. Yeah. But the record company went with Family Affair. They pushed it, and that's Billy Preston on Rhodes piano, a drum machine, Sister Rose repeating the song title between cupped hands, and Sly on vocals.
I mean, what can you say about that?
It's released in November '71, went straight to number one. It was their biggest hit.
That's kind of crazy. That was their biggest hit. It's a pretty avant-garde production.
It's such a good song. But yeah. Before we even get to the songs, you want to talk about the influence this album had?
Well, I mean,
I want to throw a bunch of people out there. Curtis Mayfield, Staple Singers, The OJs, War, The Temptations, Johnny Nash, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, The Undisputed Truth, Chi Lights, Herbie Hancock, Miles, Norman Whitfield at Motown. I mean, everything changed.
And then I think even beyond that, into like the Soulquarians, D'Angelo, Macy Gray.
Oh, yeah. It definitely keeps
influence is
influence.
Timeless, you know.
This is my favorite Sly album by a long shot. Every single song on the record's a masterpiece. Would you agree, Joe?
Yeah. There's not one bum note on this record.
Love and Hate's how it kicks off. Okay. So he sounds like, right off the bat, he's in the wrong kind of funk. It's a dirty, nasty, horrifying funk.
Yeah, this is one of the ones I was kind of referring to as like naughty. Like it's almost like a King Crimson kind of lick or something.
Yeah, and if you really sit down and look at the lyric sheet, it is about giving in and succumbing to addiction willingly and gladly. So right off the bat, this is the 60s endgame. I mean, you just look at the title. You talk about hate, you know, the bummer in the summer, the love thing, and talking about everything I've heard post Summer of Love, you could walk down Hate Street and get knifed for a bag of groceries. That's what I've heard. So that's Love and Hate for you.
Again, the lyrics on this record are kind of the secret weapon of it. They really fit the style of playing and the atmosphere, that kind of dank atmosphere. The lyrics really seem to fit right in.
They're so good. The music
he's underrated as a lyricist.
Absolutely. Then the second song, Just Like a Baby. Let's talk about the rhythm of this song, because it sounds like this lurching, staggering golem of a monster.
Greasy.
This is a very scary song with this sort of weird hollow whistle of a synth track that blows through it. And he sounds very fucked up on this song.
Yeah, this is kind of really... you know, I wonder, I would love to know how this was put together, the songs. It sounds kind of like it's a series of like a few different kind of vamps. Like, you know, a vamp is like a section in a song that you kind of just repeat kind of a figure for a set number of bars. And so it feels like it kind of goes from vamp to vamp.
Like those parts that go.
And it's got I love the little like clavinet lick that comes out of the verses. It has the sort of extreme sort of behind the beat feel that D'Angelo would kind of traffic in later.
It's so off and so perfect.
Yeah, really, I mean the vocals are just really weird and like thin sounding, like he's singing right in your ear.
It sounds fucking harrowing. It sounds like a cry for help.
Yeah, super like intimate, like weird, druggy vocal.
And then comes
it's just incredibly musical. Everything in it, everybody's playing. It's basically like a 6/8 feel. So it's kind of has like a, it has that kind of so it's like a 6/8 piece, but it's like the deepest, like most just greasy, sticky 6/8 you will ever hear.
And then moving on, we got Poet. So the question here that I always ask myself, because the lyrics are so straightforward that it's almost impossible to ascertain, is he serious or making fun of himself? I don't even know what's going on with the song, and it's very engaging for that reason. What do you think?
I mean, this song to me, Poet, it's just, again, it's just the funkiest motherfuckers in the world playing the funkiest shit possible. I think the lyrical content doesn't really matter that. I think it is kind of sincere. I think he's, you know, that he's saying it's a little bit of a mission statement, I feel like, for this record.
Yeah. But it also sometimes reads as self-parody to me, and sometimes as a reminder that he has things to do other than lay around and smoke sherm.
Yeah. I think you're kind of right. I think it is sort of I could see it as sort of like a parody kind of thing.
You never quite know where he's coming from. And that was the genius of the early Eminem.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you kind of never, he was playing around with perspective, and Sly's really doing it here. He's doing the kaleidoscope thing, but he's never lying about himself. He's just turning the kaleidoscope.
Yeah, this is one of those ones, too, that it has, I think the way that it sounds like it has the drum machine going on underneath it, and then they play on top of the drum machine.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do.
So that's kind of an interesting,
it gives it a staggered feel, right?
Well, also, it kind of gives it the effect that they're playing on a click, because the drum machine is sort of acting as a click, because you have to stay locked into it. So it's kind of modern in that respect. It's like acoustic drums, and then like this loop kind of laid on top of it. It's kind of ahead of its time in that way.
And then we move into Family Affair, which, Joe, as you know, possibly is their last number one hit.
Right.
Which we already talked about. We move into probably the naughtiest song on the record, Africa Talks to You, The Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah.
So then moving on, because we already touched on that earlier, the King Crimson-ness of it, let's talk about the shortest song in history. The title track of the record, There's a Riot Going On.
Which we'll play for you right now.
It's listed. That's right. We're going to try to clear the rights.
Here it is.
Wait, hold on.
And that was it.
That was it.
Okay.
So in 1997, Sly said that the track had no running time because, quote, I felt there should be no riots. Anyway, moving on. But it is listed on the album. So, side B, we start with a very, very good song, Brave and Strong. Yeah. The horn lines, again, something we talked about before, they sound like they're mocking him. And he sings about really serious shit. Frightened faces to the wall, oh, can't you hear it, your mama call? Out and down, ain't got a friend, you don't know who turned you in. This is some fucked up stuff.
This is paranoid Sly doing it at his most paranoid.
And then he's ducking and running. You Caught Me Smiling. It's kind of a faint to the left.
One of my favorite Sly songs ever.
Great song. It's got this lazy vibe to it that is just absolutely spot on.
The bass line is just that great like lyrical bass line.
And then possibly my favorite song on the record and potentially my favorite Sly song along with I Want to Take You Higher is the song Time. So he is so fucking stoned, and it is so terrifying at a bass level.
It's a bummer classic.
It's such a good song. I never get sick of hearing this. And then there's, at 2 minutes and 43 seconds, he makes this grunt that is one of the scariest moments in rock history for me, and it always gets me down right to the core. You got to go straight to discograffiti.com and play it from the playlist, because this is... It really is one of the great classics.
This one sort of sums up the Riot aesthetic the most to me. This is kind of like if you really want to get into the vibe and sound of this record, this is what it's all about, the song Time.
It really is.
It's one of the great bummer songs. What are some other classic bummer songs that go on your bummer playlist? On the Beach, That one go.
Yeah, but even from Sly would
be... This is even more of a bummer than On the Beach.
Yeah, you could pick any fucking song from this record. But then he does kind of a...
It just sounds like he's like a leaf that's going to blow away.
You know what's interesting from the... He does. It's kind of his Till I Die period, right? So then I find it's interesting because there's a clarity of thought on time. It's you know, wandering, but there's a clarity to it. And then it goes to Spaced Cowboy, which is just kind of like his thought process going to shit because of Sherm wandering.
Yeah, that's the closest thing I like. I still love Spaced Cowboy.
It's great.
It's the closest thing on the record to kind of a throwaway.
Yeah.
But still, you know,
everything
still
I
amazing.
Like is nice. That's why I try to have it twice. Yeah. There he is again, telling us the truth.
Yeah.
However unfortunate. Then running away with the mocking horn lines again. And then the classic refrain, look at you fooling you, which is absolutely classic Sly. So honest, it's painful to listen to.
I mean, yeah, running away is like, come on, it's too good. It's just everything about it is great.
The deeper in debt, the harder you bet. That's what he was doing.
The heart that has that great bounce in the verse, like, and then the great B section with that little funky guitar lick. And oh, man.
It's perfect.
It's so damn good.
And then we have how
can you be that high and make music like
I know.
That? It's pretty amazing.
Then, let's say it didn't last long, dude.
It kind of did.
Lasted longer than it should have, that's for sure. But then it ends with the only group performance on the record, Thank You for Talking to Me, Africa, with the refrain that to me, again, to call back to that first record and the knee-jerk change in direction because of Clive Davis's direction, Slive Davis. That would be a fly machine thing, right? In any case, dying young is hard to take. Selling out is harder. I think this is part of the tapestry of thought that went into this record. This is 5 stars. Easy. This is a hard 5.
So, yeah, there's a riot going on. If that's not a 5-star record, there are not such things as 5-star records. This maybe you should make up a six-star record.
It really is. I agree with Joe. So then we have to wait 2 years because there's a lot of the PCP is not going to smoke itself.
Right.
In 1973, Fresh comes out, which I call Diet Riot. So you just look at the cover, Joe. You got a Richard Avedon picture, who is, you know, the star-making machine. He's got a heel-clicking, overly smiley expression on his face that right off the bat seems to negate the negation that he tried to shove down our throats on Riot. He's already flipped his hand, and that's the problem here, is that we know what's going on.
Well, the other thing going on in the background is he's still, like, he's becoming unbookable as a touring artist. So troubles are starting to mount. So this record, Fresh, was still pretty successful for him, but the troubles, the financial troubles, and it's shit's starting to get crazy. So
yeah, I'm talking about this, record quality.
I think it reflects it in the record quality because he must feel like, okay, I can't make another Riot. I can't, you know, I got to make something that's gonna put the butts back in the seats and get me some goodwill. That's a lot of from this point forward. That's kind of a running theme with Sly. It was like, okay, I need to win back some goodwill.
I guess it started here. You're right. Yeah. But like part of him cared, part of him didn't care. You know, I mean, the band is falling apart at this point.
Well, there's a key new player on the scene, which is Andy Newmark. So
right.
This one, they're not doing the drum machine thing anymore, really, on this one. And it's Andy Newmark has a very focused, tight and polished kind of sound. And the band takes that on.
Larry's gone.
Right. So it's a kind of more of a nimble.
Rusty Allen is in the band.
Yeah. So
and
it's a pretty dope rhythm section.
Martini's got Pat Rizzo now on sax next to him.
Right.
So this is their last album placing in the top 10. So things are starting to tumble. But just looking at the tracks themselves, to me, as far as I'm concerned, there's 4 great, great songs on this. And then there's some good songs and some shit for the first time. So do you agree with that assessment or no?
I like most of Fresh.
A lot of people love Fresh.
I liked it. I liked it quite a lot.
The problem to me is its proximity to Riot, which is so towering. It's just in its shadow to me. So In Time is great. You start with the most Riot-like line of the entire record, which is there's a Mickey in the tasting of disaster. And also the line I switched from Coke to Pep. and I'm a connoisseur. And then the other great songs, I think, are If You Want Me to Stay, a cover of Doris Day's Que Sera Sera, their only cover ever, and Skin I'm In.
Well, I like a bunch of other ones. So In Time, the first tune, it's a little, this one is a little, does have that Riot strategy. It's a bit of that dense kind of funk, like the funk on Riot.
But it's got a happier, jumpier sound.
It does. I think that's mostly the rhythm section. I think it's mostly like it's a very tight and kind of polished.
But quiet.
Yeah.
It's got that naughtiness that was in Riot, that's gone.
Yeah. Well, that's gone. It's still, I think rhythmically it's still pretty complex. At least that first song, in Time, it's a similar kind of like rhythmically complex thing. It's a different kind of pocket. It's a different kind of groove they have with the new rhythm section. If You Want Me to Stay, that's a classic single. I like the song Frisky a lot. That one is,
I like it. It's not on the same level.
That one's kind of a gem of a funk tune to me.
Thankful and Thoughtful is good.
I don't know. I like that's that one's like got a greasy kind of feel to it.
I do not like that song. I don't know. Satisfaction is to me, along with Keep On Dancing, which has the refrain "Dance to the Music."
Yeah, that one I wasn't
really
into.
He's already shitting out bullshit.
But I don't know. I like the playing, and I don't know. Like that groove is pretty.
I don't know. Whatever happened to Dying Young is hard to take and Selling Out is harder. To me, this is like massive sellout shit.
Well, and I like Babies Making Babies too.
Yeah, that one's decent.
Lyrics are a little on the nose on that one.
It's too on the nose to me. But I mean, it's anathema to the sort of multi-layered, burnt out thing that he did on Riot. So on that one is ducking and hiding, and you know,
this one, okay, so like a record like Fresh and then the record after it are kind of similar in a way. It's a similar lineup, and that the band has a similar kind of sound, those two records I can kind of enjoy just on the playing level. Mm-hmm. The grooves themselves, the actual like the quality of the funk is very high. They start to lose that to me kind of after that. The players are kind of not as premium, and the funk is just not as deep. And to me, Fresh is a really good funk record. I'm trying to hold it apart from Riot and not compare it directly to Riot. I mean, you can really only make a record like Riot once. But on its terms, as a funk record, I like Fresh a lot. I gave it 4.5.
I give it 4.
It's not that far off.
No, it's not that far off. I have to say, though, on this particular trawl, as I was listening to the band, I mean, everything chronologically, you know, live appearances, whatever we could get our hands on. Even my notes are 21 pages long, typewritten. So when I was listening for the purposes of this trawl, Fresh was the most disappointing record. I was expecting to like it in a different way than Riot. And maybe my approach was wrong. It was a post-Riot light sort of experience. But, you know, then it moves into a record that I think truly does get short shrift. Now Sly is sort of moving into being a celebrity. So, or attempting to, anyway. So, some backstory first. He married a model/actress already in trouble named Kathy Silva. On June 5th, 1974, during a sold-out performance at Madison Square Garden. So they made predictably flamboyant plans for a laser light show, a real-life angel flying on wires, dropping gold glitter all over the audience.
Did Sly show up?
See, that would have been totally epic. He marries Kathy Silva, and the couple actually went up separating in 1976 after their son was mauled by Sly's dog, Gunn. So Silva later told People magazine, "I didn't want that world of drugs and weirdness."
Man, Gunn is a fucking bummer, man.
But before any of that shit could go south, Sly made sure to pump out his Domestic Bliss LP, and it was called Small Talk. Sly and the Family Stone's 7th LP and the very last, to feature the original band, however modified. So their last top 40 hit ever was Time for Living, a mellow and underrated outing for them. This is Even at this early stage in his career, Joe, this is really obscure for him. And it, to me, it's a better record than Fresh. It's mellow, super chill, almost like the Beach Boys' Friends, this little gem. And there are strings. Sid Page is even listed as a band member for this record.
Well, this is one of my favorite kind of under the radar, like underappreciated, underrated albums. It's the same band as the last record and it's same kind of approach. But this one, I think, is more across the board. The material is better quality.
And the mood.
And the, and
the
it's,
mood
and,
is
yeah.
unified.
So, yeah, Fresh is kind of weird. It's kind of transitional. The, Small Talk has kind of a clear mood and feel to it.
It does. There's a lazy, groggy charm to the record that kind of fits.
It feels, sounds kind of optimistic.
It does. It fits a Sunday morning. So,
No bummer vibes in this.
No,
one.
Not at all. Not at all. So
it's downright like warm and fuzzy.
Like right out of the gate, you have the title track, which is basically Baby Gaga Goo Goo and the newlyweds babbling happily yet incoherently in the background. It's, you know, a minor song, but it totally sets the mood. I would say it's a great song.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a lot of great songs. The material on this record's fantastic.
By this kind of mid-period, Sly, they had kind of a strategy going. Well, I guess he kind of always did this, where he would just come up with a great funk vamp. He would just come up with a great feel and groove, and they would play the shit out of it, and then it seems to me that the way they did it was they would probably graft a song on top of it. Yeah, they have
right.
like their call and response vocals. There'd be like a hook. But the heart of a lot of these songs is like just some whatever sick like vamp and groove they came up with.
Right, right. So the first major song on the record is Say You Will, which is just fucking awesome.
Great pocket. I mean, great feel.
Really, I mean, different feel than the previous records, but really welcome and very pleasant. The same with Mother Beautiful, Time for Living, Can't Strain My Brain. Loose Booty's a fucking classic.
Yeah.
That song is amazing. And the Beasties obviously sampled it for Shadrach.
Yeah, a very prominent sample with the Dust Brothers.
And
the
they
Beasties.
Did a hardcore punk version of Time for Living, which is kick ass on Check Your Head.
The Sly Time for Living tune is super cool, super mellow, kind of like that was like you were saying, that's like another last radio hit, but you know, good hook in that song.
My favorite song on the record is Wishful Thinking. Yeah,
those sparse kind of ballads like that always hit the spot for me.
To me, it's almost like it would vie for inclusion on Riot, where it recorded at that time. This Is Love, Better Thee Than Me, Living While I'm Living. I would say great record. I would give it 4.5 stars.
I also gave it 4.5.
Nice. Joe, we are very similar people, but different in crucial ways.
We're so different that you gave Fresh 4 stars and I gave it 4.5.
Right.
But somehow we make this friendship work.
Somehow. So at this point, since 1970, live bookings for Sly and the Family Stone have dropped precipitously. Promoters were super cautious about Sly or one of the band members missing the gig, refusing to play, or just flat out passing out from drugs. In January 1975, the band booked itself at Radio City Music Hall in New York. This is the end of the band. The venue wound up being only 1/8 occupied, and Stone and the band had to scrape together money to return home. This was the breaking point. Following the Radio City gig, the band broke up. Sly and the Family Stone were no more. Join us on Part 3 of Sly and the Family Stone, or better known as Sly Stone.
And then this Family Stone again, and then Sly Stone again.
Check out discograffiti.com and go right binge listening into Discograffiti Sly Stone Part 3.
And binge all of our, binge every episode that's up there.
They're all worthy.
You can they're all free. You go up there and you click on them, and you can hear them.
All likable, chock full of information and great interplay.
We will see you next time on Part 3. Thank you.
Can't wait.